C1S. Number 10A.
Now, we go back to our subject, and we have been doing mind as mind, mind as spirit, mind as soul, just showing the way how a true understanding of our oneness with mind is the manual of mind with us. And the moment we touch that oneness of mind with us, something is going to happen. In mind as mind, it is going to happen that we begin to realize, because that mind is all, that therefore mortal mind is a misnamed mind, a false sense of mind. That in mind of spirit we begin to realize that this mind, capital M, can only be discerned spiritually and never mentally. So that matter, just as a mental state, subjective state, is not the end of the question. That we have to see further until we see that mind, mortal mind, disappears entirely. But how? Realizing that mind must be spiritually discerned, we begin to realize in soul, mind as soul, that therefore this one mind which we discern spiritually is the only ruling mind, and therefore the cause of every effect. And now we come to mind as principle, which leads us a step further. I have epitomized it as the divine mind is the one and only principle of the divine system of metaphysical healing. In her research, Mrs. Eddy shows now that she had to look further deeply into the whole discovery, and says that after a lengthy examination of my discovery, I'm on page 111-26, but after a lengthy examination of my discovery and its demonstration in healing the sick, this fact became evident to me that mind governs the body not partially but wholly. You get a sense of the divine principle including all ideas, and therefore she calls that metaphysical system of treating disease, because now she has seen that it is whole. In a system, every factor is related to every other factor in a way that they are cooperating harmoniously. Then she speaks about testing her discovery. See, now she goes on in testing it, just what any other science would do when they have found out a new idea. They call it a hypothesis, and until it is tested, they can't say it is a fact. So the same thing happened to Mrs. Eddy, that she had this hypothesis that mind is all and matter naught, and now she tested it to see if it is more than just a hypothesis, if it is really a divine principle which she had found. And so has found that whenever she applied it scientifically, that it was the most effective curant agent in medical practice. And that set the end, so to say, to her discovery. Now she has seen that this mind is really the one principle of healing, and that this principle of healing is such that it covers every argument in healing. This brings her naturally to the question in the next paragraph, if other schools of philosophy may not have the right also of divine revelation. And she denies that. And she denies it by saying that these schools of philosophy, no matter if it's Socratic, Platonic, or Spencerian, or some other school, that they may have occasional gleams of truth. But just the same, because they have only gleams of truth, and therefore no consistent system, no coherency in every part, they can't be called a science. So we have to be careful that if we read something about Plato, especially, or do you say Plato?
Plato.
See, especially Plato, that we don't say that he has already seen Christian Science, because he has that theory of ideas, the doctrine of ideas. One always can get occasional gleams, but this does not prove anything. What proves that something is actually true is if one can go out from principle. And going out from principle instead of from men's opinion. But going out from principle, you arrive at exact conclusions which are factual and divine. All else is man-made systems, as she calls them, and they remain wholly human in their origin and tendency. So, it isn't so much what we may find here and there as truth in some of the philosophies that makes them valuable. The deeper question is, what is the basis from which we reason? We can have a very good human nature and have a philosophy built on that. We can have a very bad human nature and build up a philosophy on that. Just like, nihilism? You call it nihilism? Nietzsche?
Yes.
And so on. You can build up all sorts of philosophies on the human mind, whatever that nature is. But we are not concerned with that, because the basis is that which interests us. And therefore, the basis, which is principle, it gives us the true philosophy of everything. That's why she goes on, right on, and says, from the infinite one, in Christian Science, comes one principle, and its infinite idea. And with this infinitude come spiritual rules, laws, and the demonstration, and so on. So, whenever we unite in consciousness with the one principle and reason from that principle, then we get the true idea of everything. We can't get the true idea of anything by reasoning from man-made systems, from human opinions, and trying through metaphysical reasoning to exalt thought above the physical and find a solution for anything. And here again we find this pure view that when we go out from one principle with this infinite idea, we find only the rules and laws of this principle and never anything else. Never anything else. This principle cannot distinguish between ideas and illusions. It's impossible. Light cannot distinguish between light and darkness. But the very nature of being idea is dispelling illusion. So having one mind and seeing that one mind is the principle of all ideas, we find the universe of ideas, the laws of ideas, and that is the answer to the situation. Then we will leave out the rest and go on to the next tone of life at the bottom of the page 112, line 32, where she begins to show that what may have seemed up to now to be academical, abstract, intellectual in her reasoning, but that is not so. That this abstract, correct, strict reasoning, deduction from her findings, drawing conclusions without taking notice of any human arguments and opinions, that is not something cold, that is not the letter, but that is really warm, that it is not the dead body of science, pulseless, cold, inanimate, as it may seem at the beginning. As one loves these tones, as one begins to love the way she reasons, the way and the conclusions she draws, it becomes to be warm, alive, tender, comforting, all that which has to do with the spirit of this science. Therefore, she says, the vital part, the heart and soul of Christian Science is love. And truly, all these conclusions, all these deductions, the moment one begins to see them, that behind them is a comforter, the divine comforter, that they are the solution, really, to every problem, that they are the solution to all our human problems, that it not only governs the body wholly, but that it governs the whole world wholly, not partially. And as one begins to see the wonderful tenderness and comfort and salvation that lies in taking the right standpoint, in not leaving anymore the divine standpoint from which to go out, not anymore acknowledging another standpoint, and therefore having no more a sense of opposites of good and evil, where the equipotence of God is established in one's heart, and just sees that there isn't a question of evil or good going on, of something going wrong or something going wonderful, but that there is only one thing going on, love, having an idea, an infinite idea, a telefinalistic idea, sorry, do you know that word?
Yes.
An idea that has an aim in view towards which everything is working. That's telefinalistic or teleological, just as you like it. Terms which are so warm, even if they are deviations from the Greek which we don't know. But in their sense, you see, in their sense, to feel that we are integrated, that our whole life, that everything is integrated into that telefinalistic aim of love, which says only love operates, and that love operates always for the good of everything, then we never anymore have a feeling that because something in the human doesn't go as we like it to go, that's the work of animal magnetism. That's the work of the devil. We would never have it anymore. That's why the chapter of animal magnetism had to come before, to show there is no animal magnetism. At the beginning, we must show the student that what seems to be evil and so on is not personal, that it is not, has not nothing to do with place and person and things, and that we call it animal magnetism. But in the chapter Animal Magnetism, we have seen that Mrs. Eddy discards the possibility of animal magnetism. And then comes the sixth chapter. Then thought is ready to accept that it isn't a question, is science going on or is something the effect of animal magnetism? then we know that animal magnetism is nothing. Therefore, all is mind. And we accept the fact that all is mind, whatever happens. And it's a comfort. And if we see that as love, then this view is not called pulseless, intellectual, academic. Then it is really warm, really comforting, something which we can trust and rely on and which we know is protecting us and helping us and encircling us. This leads us to the next subtone of truth, which I have tried to epitomize. And it's always difficult to epitomize things. I said divine metaphysics rests on self-evident truth. Everything else is a lie of a denial. Divine metaphysics rests on self-evident truth. And she gives self-evident propositions. And all those propositions which she gives are from God. All those four: God is all in all, God is good, good is mind, God's spirit being all, nothing is matter, then life, God, omnipotent, good, deny death, evil, sin, and death. You see, they are all statements from God. And everything which is stated from God is in itself self-evident. It is so evident that it doesn't need to be reasoned out, so to say. It's so natural in itself that there is no querying about it. These self-evident propositions are compared here with mathematics. And mathematics is naturally not a natural science, but is a metaphysical science. There is nothing in mathematics which is not based on metaphysics. And if Mrs. Eddy says De Quincey says so, well, that may have been an exception at her time. But today everybody says so. It has also become self-evident that mathematics is metaphysics, not divine metaphysics. I must make that clear, naturally, because that would be a great mistake. In this paragraph at the end, she gives, as a side note, metaphysical inversions. And we come to inversion compared with what we had before, namely reversion and perversion. Now, inversion is something very different than perversion. Perversion is when we state something incorrect, untrue. Inversion is always within a true statement. When we have a true statement and reverse its order, we arrive again at the true statement. And that's inversion. It's a change in the order in which elements are arranged. That's inversion. So in an inversion, it isn't a question of reversing something which is true into something which is wrong, which would be a perversion, nor is it reversing something which is wrong back into that which is true. But an inversion is a true statement which you can change in the order of its logic and arrive again at a truth. And you will see the example which she gives are all about God good. Each one of them is except the last one, combined with a synonymous term, and the last one is combined with good, which stands for God. So each one of them is a true statement, and showing if a statement is true, then any inversion of that true statement is also true. Like, there is no pain in truth, that's a true statement about God, and therefore it's true, and you can reverse it and therefore see there is no truth in pain. We arrive at new conclusions just through the rule of inversion, and that's very necessary in the practice. I point out this because in our country the antagonists against Christian Science just ridicule this rule of inversion. They say, well, it's just as ridiculous as saying there is no house in a flat, in an apartment, and there is no apartment in a house. Well, the one is really untrue and the other is true, so it's not a true inversion. So what is wrong with such a misconception about this rule is this, that the first statement must be a statement about a divine truth, and that's what she always does. If I say there is no house in an apartment, I say an error. So, you see, we have to be careful in stating such inversion, that we go out right from the beginning of an absolute truth, because it must be as exact as mathematics. And only then the rule of inversion is right. If the first statement is wrong, then inversing it, is not a true method. So be careful in reasoning things out in metaphysics that the first statement is true. And it's always true when it is about God. So there is no nerve in mind, all right, then you can inverse it and say there is no mind in nerve. And you arrive at an insight which ordinary men wouldn't agree to. They think mind is in nerve, you see. But if the statement first is made about God, that there is no nerve in the divine mind, then you have started right. You have started with a right proposition, with a self-evident proposition. Then an inversion of it must be right too. And naturally gives a new view, quite a new view, to see that there is no mind in nerve, therefore is for the treatment very important. Yes, that's about this question. To see that mind, when reasoning from mind and within mind, then everything is self-evident in itself and doesn't need any argumentation about being right or wrong. It is in itself always right. Then the next and last subject crowns the subject. I summarized it like this: the divine mind is one and all-inclusive. Therein mortal mind disappears. In the first paragraph, she has as a side note, definition of mortal mind. This is interesting because the whole chapter is on translation and not on definition. And you remember that when Mrs. Eddy wrote this chapter for the first time in 1891, she had the scientific definition of immortal mind and the scientific definition of mortal mind, and only in 1902 she changed it to translation. Here, on page 140, the first paragraph is the definition of mortal mind, and gives the definition of mortal mind as mind, spirit, soul. Not as soul, spirit, mind, as she would have if it had to do with translation. She defines first this mortal mind, what mortal mind is. And as it is defining, it is built up as mind, spirit, soul, and says, what I understand under the term mortal mind is sick and sinful humanity. Then, in a little tone of spirit, and says, meaning what? The flesh opposed to spirit. See, now she gives the separation. The human mind and evil in contradiction to the divine mind and truth. And then she gives a touch of soul and says, based on the physical senses, which makes minds many and calls mind both human and divine. So here we have a short definition of mortal mind, and therefore built up in the word order. Having shown what real, or having defined really mortal mind, then she gives in the next paragraph the divine mind. Says, but in science, now in science, mind is one, including noumenon and phenomena, God and his thoughts. Again, that sense of Immanuel, God with us. God, mind, including his own thoughts. So that we see here the absolute fact of the one mind.